If a man's son ask him for bread, will he give him a stone? The answer is yes. Rock of ages, cleft for me. There's your stone. For many, many generations, Western man has thought of his security in terms of rock. Rock has been his image of God, his image of that which he must base himself on, that is to say, his foundation. How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord! A mighty fortress is our God. In vain the surge's angry shock, in vain the drifting sand, unharmed upon the eternal rock, the eternal city stands. But for us today, it's very difficult to find a rock under our feet, because we are more and more aware that the kind of universe we live in floats. The earth, which once seemed the foundation under our feet, is now known to be an object floating in space, and not necessarily to be the center of all floating objects in space, but one far out on the rim of a galaxy, which is one among myriads of galaxies. And so, in this age of relativity, we look in vain for rocks on which to stand. For every rock, every firm foundation for human behavior that anyone might propose has all imaginable arguments against it. Anyone with a clever intellect can demolish any kind of absolutist position that anybody else cares to offer. And so what is needed in this time is not a way of life based on rocks, but a way of life based on the art of swimming in an essentially liquid situation. And so I propose in the course of these lectures to give some suggestions on moral swimming as distinct from seeking firm foundations. I've entitled this talk Metaphysics and Morals, and you might suppose that if I start off with the idea that we are living in a floating universe, I should really dispense with metaphysics, because metaphysics have always been associated with trying to propose some sort of absolute truth or absolute principles. But what I mean by metaphysics is not quite that. I mean the fundamental assumptions upon which a person bases his life. Now, a lot of us don't think that we really have any. A lot of us say that we're really not interested in those things. We're agnostics with respect to fundamental assumptions, that we're practical people, that we go ahead and do as best we can from day to day and stop bothering our heads with airy and metaphysical questions. The word metaphysical itself means something vague, lofty, and rather threadbare, and not at all down to earth. And of course, a person who says this is actually a very, very narrow kind of metaphysician. He's a pragmatist. That's one of the schools of metaphysics. He's a follower of the tradition of Bentham and William James, but he doesn't know it. He hasn't examined his metaphysics, and therefore they're liable to be bad. Nobody can help, by virtue of a human being, you cannot but be a philosopher of some kind. You have assumptions upon which you base your life, whether you know it or not. And so I think it's only fair to you for me to start out and tell you more or less what mine are. There are really two points to it. In the first place, I would say that absolutely basic to my own view of the world, which is somewhat borrowed from such philosophies as Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism in China, that the first principle of it is that what we call distinct or separate things and events do not really exist. That our universe is not a collection of cosmic flotsam and jetsam which has sort of drifted together in one place in space, but that it is an integral process which has no parts, even though there may be described within it all kinds of differing movements and shapes and processes. They are, however, not separate from each other, but go together in very much the same way as the differing organs in our own bodies. And although a human being may continue to exist after some of his organs have been removed, there comes a point when he won't continue to live if you take organs away from him. But between all the organs that we have, there is a relationship which may be called, they come into being mutually, they arise together, they are totally independent, and they are not parts in the sense that a machine has parts. A machine starts by being a collection of distinct parts. They are then welded or screwed or in some other way assembled together, and they become the total machine. But a machine is rather a unique case in this respect. Nothing much else in the universe is developed in that way. Rather, it might be said that everything that we call a part of the world, a separate thing or a separate event in it, is a function, a performance of the whole works. Just as a wave on the water is the whole ocean waving. There is no real way of separating one thing from another. But we do separate things from each other for the simple reason that unless we do so, we can't think about the world or talk about it. Because thinking is a process of classification. Classification is essentially sorting things into pigeonholes called classes. And we sort our experience into these boxes. Each one has a word on it to be its label, as animal, vegetable, or mineral, tinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, rich man, poor man, beggar, man, thief, or what you will. And so we learn to deal with it. Just in the same way as to digest food, you have to take bites, because you can't swallow a whole cow at once. So in the same way, in order to think about life, you have to bite it up into pieces. Our world is therefore fundamentally something that is all of a piece, but we can't swallow it intellectually that way. And so we have, along with our teeth, which are able to take bites off it, we have corresponding psychological faculties which are able to gaze at or observe the surrounding environment in small areas, one after another. This is called observation, attention, consciousness, and we give these areas of observation, these, as it were, grasps or bites of consciousness, the name of things or events. For things and events are units of thinking, just in the same way that inches or centimeters or pounds are units of measurement. And so, using this method, we divide the world into many separate parts, although in fact this is something that does not exist in the real physical universe in just the same way that the Earth is not actually separated into two hemispheres by the equator. Just as the equator is an imaginary line, so all the distinctions that we make between separate things and separate events are imaginary lines. but we agree to them just as we agree to the meanings assigned to words, so that we can think about the world and communicate with each other. That, I would say, then, is my first principle, that the world is an integral whole, and there are parts of it only for purposes of discussion. But, of course, as a result of taking very, very seriously the idea that the world does have separate parts, each one of us comes to identify himself as a separate part of the world. But we have very different notions of what our part in it is, and I shall develop that a little further. The second principle upon which my metaphysics is founded would be called best the principle of polarity. That is to say, that all those things or events which we classify as opposite to each other, such as light and darkness or sound and silence, are related inseparably like the front and back of a coin. The front and the back of the coin are indeed different, but at the same time they are inseparable and cannot exist without each other. You know, the Chinese character for man is an upturned V. And sometimes, in explaining this character to children, the Chinese will say, look, it's like putting two sticks together. They stand up only because they depend on each other. One stick cannot stand alone. And this is the principle of what we might call polarity or co-relativity. That there is a fundamental interdependence between motion and stillness, light and darkness, something and nothing, space and solid. But that we, generally speaking, fail to notice this because of certain limits that go with the faculty that we rely upon most for understanding the world, that is to say, conscious attention, looking at things area by area. Thus, in terms of Gestalt psychology, we tend to notice the figure and ignore the background, to pay attention to what is moving and to ignore what is relatively still, and therefore come to have a view of the world in which we believe that these poles are in fact separable from each other. That, for example, you could have light without darkness, or life without death, or pleasure without pain, or matter without space. And because this recognition of the going togetherness of things is somehow occluded and shut out of our normal consciousness, we get involved in all kinds of perfectly fruitless games, which are just as fruitless, for example, as trying to construct a perpetual motion machine in terms of Newtonian mechanics. But because we are blind to the polarity of opposites, we don't see that many of our enterprises are completely futile. And so these, you might say, two ignorances add up to a certain way of feeling about the world, which is common to almost all of us. On the one hand, the ignorance which believes that there can be such a phenomenon as a separate thing or a separate person, and the ignorance which does not see that all so-called opposites and contraries go together. What I would call the go-withness of things. That, I've sometimes said sort of jokingly, the fundamental metaphysical secret about this world is that for every outside there is an inside, and for every inside there is an outside. The two have a common boundary, a garden wall that belongs in common to the two neighbors. and they know each other as other only because of what they have in common. In other words, if I think I am myself, I only know my selfness because at the same time I know your otherness. If I didn't feel you to be other, I wouldn't know that I was me. If I didn't know there was a place called there, I wouldn't know where was here. And these things go together. Now then, our ordinary situation is that we are somewhat myopic about all this. When we consider what we mean by myself, we confine the definition of myself to a rather narrow locality. Generally speaking, most modern people would, I think, agree that myself is my physical body at the least. Although some people won't go along with that. They hold themselves to be not the physical body, but something in it, or something which the physical body transmits or manifests, namely a soul, which is a sort of spiritual existence for which the body constitutes a physical vehicle. But at any rate, the definition of this, myself, is to an important degree confined within the sphere of influence of the physical body, probably located somewhere in the head. And of course, if you feel that way, and if you feel that is yourself, then naturally this issues in a certain kind of behavior. In doing everything you can to get this self of yours in a position where it is one up on everything else for as long as it can maintain this situation, despite the fact that you know it's going to fall apart in the end, that all that you have constructed and all the power which you can gather to yourself in the course of a life is going to fade out and vanish. Nevertheless, you can manage to put off that thought, to ignore it, and say, well, let's make hay while the sun shines. Naturally, if you have any sense at all, you will soon find out that this definition of yourself is not really very practical, because you need the collaboration of others to attain your own ends. And as the proverb says, many hands make work light. And therefore you identify yourself with a larger community than your physical body. It may be a family, a village, a society in the sense of a club or church or something of that kind. It may be with a nation. It may be that you go so far as to identify yourself with the whole human race. And as you do this, you get a larger sense of self, and you get what is called a liberation from the confines of egocentricity. And everybody is always looking for that liberation for a number of reasons. First of all, nothing seems to be so boring to people in our culture as themselves. All kinds of things, from the most vicious to the most virtuous, are done in the name of getting away from oneself. Whether you become a television addict, or a booze addict, or an addict for politics, or for religion, or for whatever, all these things are various ways of getting you out of yourself and giving your life a meaning by integrating the ego with a larger pattern, just as a word acquires meaning, not standing by itself, but when it is in the context of a sentence or a paragraph. So in this way, the individual experiences a larger self. And so as he enlarges the definition of himself, so he is able to exist in greater and greater communities in cooperation with more and more people. And in this way, we find a foundation for ethical behavior, which means especially be good to the people who are in your own ego scheme. It's like species normally, biological species don't normally eat their own members. So in the same way, you don't eat Catholics if you're a Catholic, and you don't eat Republicans if you're a Republican, and so on. But you do eat the other ones. But here it strikes you, I think at this point of development in one's ego, it strikes you uncomfortably that all biological organisms belong to a mutual eating society. And this is, I think, one of the causes of a profound sense of guilt that attaches itself to all self-conscious beings. When it really comes home to you that you live only because you kill other living creatures. Now, of course, mankind as a whole is making a desperate effort to be top eater in the eating society, to be a creature which eats other creatures but which is not eaten. And in this respect, our morticians are making a very important contribution in rendering corpses totally inedible to any other kind of organism, and thus in such a way that they don't become involved again in the cycle of life. Which is a great pity when you consider all that you've taken in during the course of your lifetime, that in death you do not make some contribution to the ongoing process. But this is the rather uncomfortable foundation of biological life, that it is a mutual eating society. And although you can make gestures of protest against this by becoming a vegetarian or a fruitarian or practice what the Buddhist monks call ahimsa or harmlessness, nevertheless, it so turns out that apples and leaves also experience a rudimentary form of pain when you crush them, which was embarrassingly demonstrated by, of all people, a Hindu scientist. I asked once a devout Western Buddhist vegetarian about this, why he therefore, for this reason, eschewed eating meat. And he said he ate vegetables because they didn't scream so loud when they were killed. He was at least frank. But here is the predicament. We cannot go on living. We cannot be, as it were, a successful member of an in-group without depending upon some kind of relatively unsuccessful out-group. And this out-group may be human, it may be bovine, it may be vegetable or even insect, but we have to have it. And herein lies a fundamental problem having to do with the going together of opposites. So then, what I've demonstrated so far, I think, is this, that there is no rigid way in which you can define yourself or your self-interest. You can choose a number of ways of doing it. You can say it's just me defined as a particular ego in charge of a particular body and play that game. But as you get smarter, you find out that you need to cooperate. In other words, what you find out as you get smarter, that is to say, as you get more sensitive and as you understand how things fit together, you find out that you're not isolated and you can't be isolated. Just for example, as any scientist who makes a rigorous study of any particular phenomenon whatsoever finds that he cannot isolate this phenomenon from all other physical phenomena, that it's the most impossible thing to do, to make one event or one crucible of chemicals absolutely untouched by, uninfluenced by other events. So as you get smart, as you understand yourself, you find out that you are inseparable from other living beings and other things that surround you. So therefore, as I said, your idea of, your image of yourself grows. And in this way, one acquires meaning as the word acquires meaning through the context of the book. But you may pursue this much further, especially when you begin to understand and be puzzled by the interdependence of in-groups and out-groups. Let me look at this in two ways. Let us consider a certain biological species, which we will call A, which preys upon and is preyed upon by another group called B. Now, these groups, although they prey upon each other, have in fact a relationship just as symbiotic as the relationship between bees and flowers. Bees are nice to flowers. They give them a sexual thrill, in return for which the flowers give the bees their necessary honey, and they get along beautifully. But let us consider the relationship between other forms of life, say, snails and birds. Snails really couldn't like birds very much because the birds keep eating them. And yet without birds, the snails would be in a bad way. There would be too many of them. There wouldn't be enough food, lettuce, and stuff to go around among the snails. And therefore they're really quite beholden to the birds. And also snails have various smart tricks they can do, like having shells of a certain color so that they can disappear and not be too visible, which help them to avoid being noticed by birds. And if there were no birds around, the snails would eventually become sloppy about all this. Their shells would become flabby, and there would be altogether too many of them. And they would turn into a rather nasty mess and die of inanition. So the birds really need the snails, and the snails need the birds. Now, in exactly the same way, there are true things among human beings. Let's first of all look at this on a rather small town scale, and then we can look at it on a huge political scale. In every American community, and I suppose in every community throughout the world, there is a certain group of people who consider themselves nice people, who live, as we say, on the right side of the tracks. And they have a solidarity, they know who they are, and they get a great deal of charge out of being the best people in the community. Well, how do they fortify their communal ego? Why, naturally, by having many conversations at dinner table and at cocktail parties about how dreadful the nasty people are. In my own community, which is Sausalito, we have the hill people and the waterfront people. And the hill people are nice, and the waterfront people are not. They are beatniks. They are disreputable bohemians who grow beards and don't wash very much and have strange clothes. So the people on the hill get a tremendous charge out of talking about how dreadful it is and what the town is coming to and all that, but they enjoy this conversation immensely. And it gives them a real sense of knowing where they are. Conversely, in exactly the same way, the people who live on the waterfront enjoy themselves enormously and fortify their collective ego by talking about the squares and the bourgeoisie and the stupid businessmen involved in the rat race of selling automobiles. And they feel very good about that because they are the real in-group, whereas the nice people on the hill are the out-group. And of course, the same thing can happen among exploiting minorities and exploited masses, certain southern whites and the Negro community, mutually fortify their egos by congratulating themselves that they are not the other one. And in this way, you will come to see a very strange humor about this. Take it on the supranational scale. We have rigged the world now so that it is roughly in two camps. the so-called free world and the communist totalitarian world, the capitalists and the Marxists, or however you want to call it. And these two divisions of the world have actually worked it out so that they are amazingly necessary to each other. We have an enormous economic boom going on, very largely because of the Cold War. We need the threat of an external enemy to tell us who we are and to keep us on our toes, in just the same way that they need the threat of us to do whatever they're doing, to get some motivation for plans of vigorous social change, and of course for keeping in power the people who are in power. And I think some very smart cookies on each side have come to the realization that this is so, and that at all costs the Cold War must be kept as a going concern, but we must be meanwhile very careful to be sure that it doesn't become a hot war. Because you see, what happens the moment it becomes a hot war is that you find means of obliterating your necessary enemy. And that won't do at all. You must not obliterate the enemy. You need him. But you must not admit that you need him, because otherwise there wouldn't be a contest. Now, as you meditate on this, you begin to see something that is at the root of what might be called mystical experience, but which in academic circles I now call ecological awareness, simply because there are fashions in what kind of language is respectable. You realize that you can't, just as you couldn't have bees without flowers, really a bee flower is a single organism because it's so totally interdependent, just as much as your head is dependent on your stomach and vice versa. So where there exists even a hostile relationship between biological groups, there is in fact a symbiosis. And you begin to understand the joke that you know who you are and you know what all your virtues are only because of somebody else's vices. Let's take another example of this. Let's take philosophical opinions. There's a whole schools of philosophical and religious opinions all arguing with each other. And I've come to the point where I've simply ceased to argue. I mean, I'll argue for the fun of it, just because I do enjoy a good argument. But actually, I wouldn't know what I thought unless somebody existed to disagree with me. I couldn't possibly formulate a point of view unless I could formulate it in contrast to some other point of view. And therefore, I always feel, however much I feel that it is my philosophical duty to pitch an argument, say, against a Jehovah's Witness or some other kind of fanaticism, nevertheless, I do it with a certain reservation in the back of my mind, that I'm really very grateful to this fellow for being so extreme and therefore for defining where I am so much more clearly. I feel so much, in other words, that all different kinds of religions and philosophical opinions go with each other in very much the same way that the different biological species do, with their different games, or the different members of flower and insect and grubby and ornithological that constitute anybody's backyard. So as one does this, one becomes, in other words, more and more aware of the intense interdependence between oneself and everything that you could possibly define as other. And you find that even your the funny thing is that it's most difficult for us to swallow is that your cantankerous behavior towards others and their cantankerous behavior towards you is a form of cooperation. And at this point, you see, you become closer and closer to that strange awareness of these fact that this universe is a single process, and that you are not exactly part of it. You are it. You are inextricably involved with the whole thing, so that you might say what you call yourself is something that the whole thing is doing at the point of space and time which you call here and now. And when you get into that realization, it's very embarrassing, because you understand so clearly a position which gives you no advice as to how to behave. Because you see that really in the long run, all human behavior is as natural as the patterns of drifting clouds. Did you ever see a cloud making an aesthetic mistake? Of which you could have said, oh no, come now, you can't do that. Did you ever pick up a rock or a shell on the beach which you could seriously criticize from an artistic point of view? The strange thing is that as we look at the natural world, and that we know that it's a dog-eat-dog kind of affair and that it is very much involved in the mutual eating society, but there is something about the world of nature which we see it all balances out in the long run. And we can get to seeing human life in exactly the same way. You can see every human being as something as beautiful and natural as any cloud or any breaking wave on the seashore. And then you stand astonished, because you don't know what to say, what to recommend. Like the poet-philosopher of India, Kabir, at the end of his life used to look around and say, to whom shall I preach? He saw the divine, in other words, in everybody and in everything, in every conceivable action whatsoever, because it all goes together. And the bad man, the criminal, has his contribution to society just as much as the most virtuous of saints. And in here, you see, there is a kind of moral paralysis. And yet, it seems to me inevitable that that is the position to which any really sensitive person must eventually come. And when it comes, you are changed inside in an unforgettable, cataclysmic way. You suddenly see that this entire goings-on is a fabulous and glorious display, and that not one grain of dust in the whole scheme is out of place. But as one Chinese book that deals with this sort of thing says, you are then like a dumb man who has had a dream. You know, the sort of dream you want to tell everybody about. But if you're dumb, of course, you can't say what it was. And so in the same way, great people who have been spiritual powerhouses in the history of the world have always been trying to express this vision, mainly by exuding love towards everybody, without discrimination, making no judgments as between saints and sinners, the good and the bad, the in-group and the out-group, because they see that they all go together, and there wouldn't be the virtuous people unless the vicious helped them to that position. And so on, through every kind of distinction of saved and damned that you can think of. Now, many moralists, whether they be religious or political, can't stand any talk of that position. They say, from a religious point of view, oh, that's pantheism, which has become a real cuss word in theological circles. It's a word with you, which you simply dismiss something, like saying of somebody, oh, he's a beatnik, or he's a communist. That's simply like that, not even worth considering. So, pantheist. Because the awful thing about the pantheist is that his God doesn't take sides. And wherever we find an attempt to base morality on metaphysics, that is to say, on some foundation that you could call cosmic or universal, naturally, your foundation has to take sides. So you get your God on the side of the good against the evil, and at once you get the tortuous and difficult problem of how evil could exist in a universe presided over by a God who is perfectly good. And so, from the political point of view, people will say, oh, well, people who have this feeling that they all belong to the one and that finally, in the last analysis, it is as perfect a miracle of nature as anything else, they're just woolly-minded, unrealistic people who won't stand up and be counted, who are never committed, who wash it all over because they're unable to face reality. They want to go back to the womb and join the oceanic community of babies. And so they don't like it either. So both the theologians and, we'll say, the politically committed take a very strong stand against this, saying, you must choose. And right down in your heart of hearts, you must believe in the rightness of the side you choose. And don't let any little funny suspicion enter your head that you're not right. Because then if that suspicion is there, we can't count on you. In other words, when you get terribly serious, religiously or politically, you must go a little bit out of your head. You must treat the out group as if it were in some way not really human. This is the problem of ideological wars, in which we are fighting other people, not for understandable reasons, such as greed, to possess their property and their womenfolk, in which case we would not obliterate either their property or their womenfolk. But we are fighting them for their own good, to deliver them from an ideological monster. And an ideology cannot be knocked out with guns. But also, you can't make peace with it because it's the devil. And therefore, ideological wars are wars of extermination, wars which require unconditional surrender, which are now the enemy no honor and no dignity. He must admit that he is totally in the wrong where you put him. And so these are the most destructive wars imaginable. But that is the result of being too committed. Because when in any contest you are too committed, you have gone beyond the point where you can play the contest as a game. And if you can't play any contest in life as a game, you ought not to be involved in it. There was a famous Mughal king, who was in battle about to fight a duel with his opposite number. And the enemy king, before engaging in the duel, spat at his feet. And the Mughal king sheathed his sword and refused the duel. He said, "I will not fight because I have lost my temper." But in an age of ideological wars, and always is the case with religious wars, there is no chivalry. And chivalry is the whole art of acknowledging that your enemy is a human being, has dignity, and is above all necessary to you. And therefore you fight with him on certain terms, under certain rules, and with certain agreements. Because you know that he must not be exterminated, and he knows that equally of you. He will fight you not to get rid of you, but only to dominate you. And if he's smart, he knows that he can do that only temporarily. That if two conflicting groups are to succeed mutually, they must take turns as to who is victor and who is vanquished. There is no other way for them to get along together. So if you see that, these are the only grounds upon which you can really pick a fight. Now, being a human being, as I said, it means being a member of a mutual eating society, and there will be fights, and there have got to be fights. But in order to fight, say, in a political contest, if you firmly believe that Negroes should have equal rights with white people, if you firmly believe that we should not be fighting a war in Vietnam, or whatever it is that you believe in, you cannot wisely act on your belief unless at the same time you are willing to concede that the other side consists of human beings and that your opponents are entitled to respect. What I'm saying is then that awareness of the inextricable solidarity of yourself with this whole universe is the essential foundation for engaging in any kind of practical activity or of committing yourself to any moral enterprise in a spirit which is not one of fanaticism. In a spirit where you know that the contests between the good guys and the bad guys are fundamentally games. If you don't see that, there is a point at which you become desperate. And when a human being becomes actually desperate, it is just at that moment that he turns into the sort of fanatic which we find so disturbing. The Nazi type, the Bircher type, or the extreme leftist, militant communist. All these, you see, don't realize how the left hand needs the right and the right needs the left. And because they have their fanaticism, they can only engage ultimately in a kind of struggle which is suicidal in that it destroys both sides.
KPFK, Los Angeles.
Take, for example, another case of exactly the same thing. You are an agent of mercy. Let's suppose you're a surgeon, and therefore your life is committed to healing people of their diseases. Obviously, this is something which is terribly important to you. It's a vocation. But yet, if you care too much when you operate, your hand will shake. And that, of all things, must be avoided. It is for this reason that surgeons, in the everyday performance of their duties, take it lightly. They joke with each other over the operating table. They treat this patient, although they know it's a living person just like themselves, they treat it sometimes, you know, as something that really doesn't matter, but it's just a technical job we have to do here. Because in this way of acting that it isn't desperately important, they can keep the steady hand. Now that's the same sort of thing as knowing that everything in life that you oppose as evil is not ultimately evil, but is also life, also human, also like you. And remember how you seem from their point of view. And in this respect, you see, one develops a fundamental humor about all contests. And there is really a very important connection between humor and humanity. A person who hasn't humor hasn't humanity. Humor is, of course, fundamentally seeing the joke on oneself. And the joke on oneself is that you as self do not exist without other. Other in every sense. Other than my ego, other than what I like, other than what is in my interest. Other in every imaginable sense of that word. You are defined by that other in just the same way as back is defined by front and vice versa. When you see that, a very curious thing occurs. See, humor or laughter is in a way the opposite of anxiety. Anxiety is being confronted with the choice to be or not to be. As existentialist thinkers say, the moment you realize as a self-conscious human being that you exist, that you are immediately aware of that you might not be, so easily that you might not be. That being can so simply be overwhelmed by non-being, and so you begin to tremble. Is this choice that I have to make at every moment between this or that, is this a choice for being or for not being? And because you are all the time more carefully trying to choose, your hand begins to shake. Because you shake between, shall I do this or shall I do that? The hesitation, which way shall I go? You know, some people, when they're about to write, instead of putting the pen down directly, they wiggle a little bit and tremble, making up their minds which thing they're going to write. Well, that wobble can be very dangerous when you've got your finger on a button. Now, when you finally realize that there isn't a choice between to be and not to be, because they imply each other, just as insides and outsides do, this world is what we would call existence as a general term, is actually a vibration of being and not being. Just as light is a vibration of light with darkness, and just as a wave motion is a vibration of crests and troughs. Being implies not being, and not being implies being, as positive and negative electricity imply each other. When you see that, instead of trembling, you start to laugh. Anxiety issues in the giggles, because you've seen through the joke. And that, I mean then, is the fundamental humor, which is, as I see it, the basically necessary qualification for a moral being. One who engages in contests, yes, because life is, in the words of Heraclitus, a harmony of opposing tensions, but always knows, in whatever contest he's involved, that his enemy is a necessary enemy and a beloved enemy. So to love your enemies is not merely a gambit for converting them to your own side. It's a way of helping them to be useful enemies as distinct from demons who must merely be obliterated.
You've been